Hi, everyone. Welcome to Joe's Pub. My name is Amanda Stern. I'm the host and curator of the Happy Ending Music and Reading Series, of which you are now in attendance. Thank you all so much for coming out in the blizzard, or as the Weather Channel is calling it, the February Fury, or the winter bombing. You gotta love the Weather Channel. They're almost as good as Fox 5, who mistook the Iraq War for a video game and called it Shock and Awe. But I'm just a simple gal, so I'm just referring to it as the White Twister of 2010. Anyway, thank you all so much for coming. It is a sold-out show, though I can't really see anything, so I don't know who of you showed up or not. I'm going to get the names. We're going to make some phone calls to those people who are not here, and they're going to explain themselves to us. Thank you. Thank you. All right, so Holly Miranda's solo debut album, The Magician's Private Library, out February 23rd on XL Recordings, was recorded over the course of many late nights and 1 month with TV on the Radio's David Sitek. Is that how you pronounce it? It is now, in the role of producer. As Holly puts it, my rehearsal space was down the hall. Dave was sleeping on site. We slept all day, recorded all night for about 3 weeks. It was a pretty intense experience. If my prior recording sessions were school, this was like getting a master's. It's my great pleasure to give you the insanely talented Holly Miranda.
Thank you. How are you guys doing? How's your food?
How do I
Tiny bit more. Dear, thank you. This is pretty intense, guys. I feel like you guys can see my cavities up here. So this next song is a newer song. Newest song, I guess. I started writing it around Prop 8 and all of that bullshit. But now this is the song that actually chokes me up when I sing it, and I start thinking about my friends, you know, who are out in New York but are scared to come out to their parents, or people in Nigeria who are spending their life in prison for who they love. And love is love is love is love is love. But recently I was being interviewed in France, and the person that didn't read my bio and didn't know a thing about me, which happens a lot. Actually, no, this is in Amsterdam. And he said, so are most of your songs about your high school boyfriends? And I was like, well, I dropped out of high school. And yeah, I'm gay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Isn't she incredible? Yeah, I know. It's amazing. I totally discovered her, too, when her record label told me about her a month ago. I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe I found this amazing girl with a record contract. It's amazing. I'm wondering, though, why you never offered me the second voice up there that she got. Because I would love that. Did you hear that second voice? She got a second voice. They could give me that. Funnier, better, more successful with the audience, second voice. And then this will just be drowned out. It's perfect. All right. Joshua Ferris's first novel, Then We Came to the End, won the Hemingway Foundation / Penn Award, the Barnes & Noble Discover Award, and was a National Book Award finalist. His fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, Granta, The Guardian, and Tin House, among other publications. His second novel, The Unnamed, is the first fiction title for Regan Arthur Books. I sort of made that up. I don't know if it's true, but for our purposes, it is. He lives in New York. It's my great pleasure to give you Joshua Ferris.
I'm going to read from page 86, start on page 86. My book is about a man with a disease. His disease is he walks. He can't stop walking. And by the point in time in this section, he's been encouraged by his doctor to try like this last final trial that he's sort of making up as he goes along. And it involves trying to get a brain scan while he's walking, which is actually totally medically impossible, but it's fiction. And it prevents him, if he's going to do this, it prevents him from working because he can't quite go into work with this apparatus. He's trying to keep it very secret that he's sick, so he can't quite go into work with this apparatus on his head. And he's in the middle of an important trial. So that's probably all you need to know. Dr. Bagdasarian removed the improvised device from a small shopping bag. Tim held it in his hands and said nothing, for there was little to say about a common bicycle helmet. It had been retrofitted to perform an extraordinary purpose and manufactured exclusively and at great expense, but he wondered how such an everyday object could serve to advance an understanding of his mystery. He doubted it could, and with that doubt, as he placed the bicycle helmet on top of his head and buckled the chin strap, futility made off with his heart. The biomedical firm had installed sensors up and down the helmet's foam cushion lining. The wireless device that captured brain activity clipped easily to a belt. This silly and makeshift heroism of Dr. Bagdasarian's, which he had encouraged himself in a moment of vulnerability, was all just so much overreaching. And nothing brought that home more than the snug feel of the chin strap pinching his skin and Jane's sudden laughter at the sight of him across the table. He would try it. He would wear the helmet and hope for the right reading. But this felt like the last possible desperate grasp before the root to which he clung gave way and he plummeted down the sheer cliff. He had gone from MRIs in the Mayo Clinic to a trial made possible by sporting goods, and with no guarantee of a success that was itself of questionable value. The helmet was only a recording instrument. It offered no diagnosis, no cure. So what was the point again? Jane continued to laugh in a tenderly mocking way, tickling the doctor into a smile. But Tim despaired and felt the urge to cry. This was it, this little piece of medicalized headgear. And beyond it, he saw the hell of a permanently compromised life whose once healthy past tormented him as the plain earth does a man passed over by the grace of God. Will it work, he asked. We'll find out, said the doctor. But remember to keep it on at all times, and you should also shave your head. It will read better that way. He sheared the bulk of his hair that night with clippers, then let the mirror guide him as he ran the blade over his knobby bumps. Creamy water dripped from his chin. The stark, pale surface that emerged startled him. He didn't know he had this look, hiding all this time beneath a civilized trim. He was menacing or ailing or just hatched from an egg. He dressed and strapped the skull into the helmet and joined Jane in bed. "I'm happy you changed your mind about this," she said. He was thinking about the consequences. He could not go into work now, and he didn't think it was an equitable trade-off, his life in exchange for a shot in the dark. But the choice had been made, and so it had to be said that above all, above living itself, he just wanted some measure of understanding, some small answer that might stand in for the clarification of all the mysteries in the world. Then suddenly he rose off the bed and grabbed the backpack and walked out. She watched him go. Eventually, she leaned over and turned off the light. Better luck next time, she thought in the dark. Better luck making the stars align. Wouldn't it have been a luxury to have some crystal ball into which a diviner gazed to map for the young couple their future in sickness and in health, the specifics therein? This one, pointing to the man, is no good for you. Not too far down the line, sweetheart, he will break, and you will be left carrying the load, and a heavy load it will be. Abort the union now while you still have the chance, or accustom yourself to the short end of the stick, because a failing body is no grounds for divorce. A failing body, and not even your own, becomes your personal cross to bear. And how fair is that? How desirable? She hated these thoughts. They stole over the better part of her in the weakness of the night. She was waiting in half-sleep for the phone to ring. She hated herself for imagining the concept of medical prenuptial. You are free to go if he turns too human too quickly. If his body derails, save yourself the grief and the heartache of being nursemaid and watchman. Take intact your health and your future and go. You have a life to live. Unburden yourself. Becca hung around all day while her dad watched nonstop television in his bicycle helmet. Her mom paid her as much as she would have been paid at Starbucks or wherever, and now she didn't have to get a shitty part-time job for the summer. She just had to hang around waiting for him to leave and follow him if he did. Her mom hadn't quit her job to follow him around, but she still picked him up and took care of him when she wasn't working. But she still wanted someone to look after him during the day, so when the summer came around, she offered to pay Becca to keep an eye on him. "How come he doesn't just hire somebody," she asked, "like a bodyguard or something? It's not like we don't have the money." "He doesn't want that." "Why not?" "He's too independent." "He doesn't seem independent when he calls you at 3 a.m. and you have to go pick him up in Queens." "Do you want the job or not?" said Jane. Her mom told her not to be too obvious about it because it was more or less like she was babysitting. And it was a little weird to babysit your dad, the man who makes you do little chores and punishes you and tells you over and over again all the ways there are to be happy. He told her about more ways to be happy than you could ever try out, even if you had 20 lives. But watching him was better than some shitty part-time job, except that day after day, he stayed on the couch and never moved. The whole point to the helmet was to record his brain waves or whatever. The whole point to babysitting him was to follow him wherever he went. But he wasn't going anywhere, but the couch and his brain waves weren't doing anything but watching TV. Becca still thought her dad was mental. She didn't want to think of it that way, but whoever heard of what he had? Not even the internet. One morning she woke up and he was sitting on the edge of her bed, holding her DVD box set of the first season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. "Can I take this?" he asked. "What for?" "To watch." "You?" "There's nothing else," he said. He took it away with him, and a few minutes later, she headed downstairs in her hoodie, David Bowie tee and black sweats, on her feet a pair of Sylvester the Cat slippers, a holdout from childhood, in which she shuffled across the kitchen floor. Her father was in the middle of the first episode. She put 2 Pop-Tarts into the toaster and fixed herself a cup of coffee with cream and sugar. She placed the Pop-Tarts on a paper towel and walked over to the recliner and sat down. She ate her breakfast during the concluding 5 minutes of episode 1 and the opening minutes of episode 2. She had seen the episode 1,000 times, but happily watched it again, surprised to be watching it with him and pleased to be getting paid for it. At one point he said, "What'd she just say?" And she repeated the line for him, and then they sank back into silence. He forwarded through the opening credits and they watched the next three episodes. When they were through, she got up to use the bathroom. He got up to change discs. She came out of the bathroom and he was waiting for her before starting the next episode. It was a favorite of hers and she wondered how well she knew the lines, so she decided to repeat out loud a brief exchange between Buffy and her friend Willow, which caused him to look over. She continued to repeat the lines perfectly all the way to the opening credits, and he continued to look over as the theme music came on. "My God," he said, "how many times have you watched this?" They finished another episode. Around one, he asked if she wanted lunch. They ate their sandwiches in front of the TV, and when they were through, she took the plates without disturbing him and put them in the dishwasher. She returned to the recliner as he got up to resettle the bedsheets under him and fluff up his pillow and then started another episode. "How many do we have left?" he asked. "Like five," she said, "but I have the second season upstairs." "How many seasons are there?" "Seven," she said. "Dad, what made you want to watch Buffy?" Growing up, she had had all the posters on her walls. She bought every offer of merchandise, the comic books and the novelettes and the magazines, the T-shirts and patches, the notebooks, pens, and pencils. She belonged to the fan clubs and ordered autographed 8x10 headshots of the actors. He once sat on the edge of her bed when she was in the eighth grade and asked if there was anything at all, that he could do to make her happy. And she said that the only time she was maybe happy was when she was watching Buffy. "I was curious about it," he said to her now. Within the week, they had finished the second season. He asked her if she had the third. Between the third season and the fourth, he didn't need to ask. She just got off the recliner and brought the next season down from her bedroom. They were in the middle of the sixth season when he unexpectedly sat up mid-episode and turned away from the TV. He looked straight ahead toward the fireplace. He set the remote down on the coffee table. He unbuckled the chin strap and peeled the bicycle helmet from his shaved head. It was startling to see him bald. It was almost like he suffered from a real disease, like cancer or something. He placed the helmet and its portable device next to him on the sofa. "Should you really be taking that off, Dad?" "Why am I not walking?" he asked, more to himself than to her. "Where is all the goddamn walking gone?" It was the very thing she'd been asking herself for weeks. Mike Cronish drove to the courthouse every morning with R.H. Hobbs in the back of a tinted SUV. He reassured his client, who had taken to calling him at home late at night, about the previous day's proceedings, and then prepared him for what would likely happen during the day ahead. The driver let them off at the foot of the courthouse steps, which they climbed in the 100-plus heat. They made it through security, where the marshals took away their cell phones and Blackberries, and they entered the courtroom together. The judge began the day's proceedings promptly at 9:30. Cronish and his client walked through the gate separating the gallery from the well at exactly 22 after. Peter was already present, managing the work of two junior associates and three paralegals. They were assembled now no differently from the way they had been every morning since the trial began, with one exception. To the right of Peter, in Cronish's chair, sat a man in a gray suit with a bicycle helmet on his head. When the two men came into view, Tim greeted them. He stood up and shook hands with Cronish and R.H. awkwardly with his left hand. Though it was now summer, the effects of his frostbite lingered. Cronish asked him what he was doing there. "I've just been getting the rundown from Peter," he replied. "I'm ready to help any way I can." Cronish set his briefcase on the table. "What do you mean, the rundown?" "I'm all caught up," he said. "Peter and I talked." "About what?" R.H., the client, interrupted them. "I thought you were supposed to be with your wife in the hospital," he said. "If it was so important to be with your wife, why aren't you at the hospital?" Tim didn't look at R.H. He looked at Cronish and reiterated that Peter had caught him up and that he was ready to get to work. He also wanted Cronish to know that he'd been reading the transcripts nightly and, frankly, no disrespect intended, they could use his help. Cronish did not want R.H. to know that they had just walked in on the greatest breach of professional protocol he could remember in all his years as a trial lawyer, but he was having difficulty seeing straight. He asked R.H. to have a seat. "Why is he here?" R.H. demanded. Tim's reappearance could only mean one thing to R.H., that his trial was going worse than he suspected and that they had to call in a man away from his wife's deathbed in order to salvage it. "Where were you 3 weeks ago? Have a seat, R.H., said Cronish. Why haven't you been here from the beginning? Cronish gave Peter a look, and Peter understood immediately. He jumped up, took gentle hold of R.H.'s arm, and started coaxing him into the chair. R.H. went reluctantly. What is he doing here? He asked Peter. Cronish would have preferred to talk to Tim privately, away from R.H., the prosecution team, and all those looking on from the gallery, but the judge was expected in less than 5 minutes and would not be pleased to find the defense team's lead counsel absent from the courtroom. He remained standing, as did Tim, and spoke to him in a soft whisper. What the hell? What the fuck? What the fuck? What the fuck? What the fuck? Hey, Mike, go easy, said Tim. I'm here to help. Help how? Any way I can. There is no way you can. Come on, Mike. I was the architect of the strategy. Peter's got me all caught up. Fuck caught up, Tim. We're 3 weeks into trial. You're the architect of a strategy that's radically changed. Do you not see? Do you not understand the delicate dynamic? Look at the man. Look what you've done. The fucking protocol, man. Hey, Mike, you arrogant bastard, said Cronish. This has nothing to do with R.H. and everything to do with you. And why are you wearing that fucking helmet? Read this, he said. He handed Cronish a photocopy of an article from the New England Journal of Medicine. John B. was the pseudonym the authors had assigned him. The article detailed his walking condition and debated its causes. The psychiatrist believed his situation came from a physical malfunction of the body, something organic and diseased, while the neurologist pointed to the scans and the tests that revealed nothing and concluded that he had been suffering something psychological. Each camp passed the responsibility for his diagnosis to the other, from the mind to the body, back to the mind, just as they had done in private over the course of his endless consultation. Cronish flipped through the pages he had been handed. What is this? I'm John B., said Tim. Who? The subject of that article. Cronish looked at him in disbelief. Are you unaware of the fucking protocol, man? Just as he said this, the judge walked through the chamber's door and the marshal called out for all to rise. Cronish was caught holding the article Tim had given him. Please be seated, said the judge. When Tim sat down, Cronish realized he intended to stay. He had no choice but to sit as well if he wished not to draw attention to himself. As he did so, he considered rising again and asking the judge for permission to approach. He would ask for a 15-minute recess in which he would take Tim outside the courtroom and beat him blind behind a dumpster. But he preferred not to request permission to approach because R.H. worried about conversations he didn't participate in. He was also loath to ask the judge for a recess before the day had even begun. Cronish was momentarily paralyzed. He was never a man to be paralyzed. He turned to Tim, who was sitting next to him, awaiting the resumption of a trial he'd been absent from since day one. Take that helmet off, he whispered. What? That goddamn bicycle helmet on your head, take it off. I can't. Cronish stared. Take that ridiculous fucking helmet off your head, Tim, before the fucking judge notices. I won't, said Tim. For a moment of blinding discomfort, the two sides of Cronish battled for primacy. Reason, which knew any sudden movement would be bad for his client, and rage, which wanted to rip the helmet off Tim's head and Tim's head with it. When I get back this evening, he said, I'm calling an emergency caucus among the partners, and I'm recommending that you be stripped of partnership. I have a right to be here, said Tim. You have no fucking right to be here. Does the defense have something it would like to share? Asked the judge from the bench. Cronish stood. No, Your Honor. Members of the prosecution were peering over. Cronish heard the strokes of a sketch artist behind him and felt the gallery looking on. Is that Mr. Farnsworth? Asked the judge. Tim rose. It is, Your Honor. You have arrived at your destination, Mr. Farnsworth, said the judge. Why are you still in your helmet? He's not staying, Your Honor, said Cronish. I am staying, Your Honor, said Tim. I have not yet appeared before Your Honor during these proceedings, but I would like to request permission to appear now. As these words were making their way to the judge, Tim turned, grabbed his backpack, and began to walk out of the well. On second thought, Your Honor, he said, turning his head around to address the judge, as onlookers seated on both sides of the gallery watched from their wooden pews. What is going on here? Asked the judge. Tim walked past the marshal and pushed the door open. Mr. Cronish, what is going on? Cronish had his back to the judge. He was watching Tim Farnsworth walk out of the room. Then the door swung shut, and he turned around to face his inquisitor. Cronish's mouth was open, but nothing came out. Thank you.
that was Josh Ferris. The next author of the night is Ron Carlson, and when I met him earlier, he said that I should just point at him and tell him what to do, and he would do it. And none of you have done that for me tonight. Very upsetting. So very thankful to Ron Carlson for giving me that power, which I have not used, but I'm about to. Ron Carlson is the award-winning author of 4 story collections and 5 novels, most recently The Signal. His fiction appears regularly in Harper's, The New Yorker, Playboy, and GQ, and has been featured on NPR's This American Life and Selected Shorts, as well as in Best American Short Stories and the O. Henry Prize Stories. His novella, Beanball, was recently selected for Best American Mystery Stories. He's the director of the UC Irvine Writing Program and lives in Huntington Beach, California, and he's flown all the way here to be with you. It's my pleasure to give you Ron Carlson.
I'm very happy to be here. I wrote a series of stories that has not been published in a book about 2 married people, Lorraine and Ron, who run a dry cleaners, and in the back there's a laboratory. And the stories have titles like Asteroid Intervention, in which they try to develop a laser that prevents asteroids from striking the Earth, and 1,000 Miles Per Gallon, which is self-explanatory, and this story, At the Broken Ridge, in which it starts with a nod at the wonderful writer Stuart Dybeck, the first sentence of one of his stories. At the Broken Ridge. We were surprised when our research on the time machine paid off and we constructed a working time machine. We went back in time for a while and then decided to cancel the project and destroy the plans. Mankind wasn't ready for a functioning time machine. Mankind liked to think of time machines, but they were not prepared for actual time travel. We were worried when we went back in time that we would change the course of history. But we did it a few times, moving things on people's desks and changing things in letters, and we averted one accident, but none of those things changed history. We traveled back in time, but we were always in this town. There was no chance of getting to Hitler's grammar school and pushing him into the coal chute. We didn't have the money, and it would have been hard to recognize him. It would have been tough to push any kid that way. We thought about warning people about getting on the Hindenburg by sending a telegram, but it turns out they had warnings. Everybody always had warnings, and still things happened. We couldn't do much. Sometimes it feels as if things cannot be averted, and people call this fate. We've done a good deal of fate research, and it always comes out the same. The results are that we have difficulty averting things even in the present. Last week, I backed our van into a fire hydrant on my way to deliver all the clean uniforms to Jimmy's Ice Cream, and I dented the back door. It makes a wicked crick now that when you lift it open. Every time I hear it, I wish I could have averted that event. On our trip to the past, one of the things we actually averted was Lorraine's fall from the township bandstand when she was 7. When she slipped this time, instead of going backward and suffering a compound fracture of her left arm, Lorraine and I were standing below, and Lorraine caught her. The little girl laughed and ran off, but when we got back to our present time, Lorraine still had the scar. Regardless, we decided to destroy the plans. It felt odd. Lorraine and I don't destroy things. We try to build things. Our asteroid laser gun was a failure, but powerful lasers are beyond us. When we traveled in time, we were pleased to see people we knew. For example, we saw Lorraine's father there at the old house. He was pouring cement in the driveway with Paul and Ernie Moxley. They were like uncles to Lorraine. She remembered their shirts and the way Ernie always worked with just one strap of his overalls over his shoulder. Her father was very handsome. But in the past, these people didn't recognize us, and we ended up acting strange, and after we'd walked by the house twice, we just went over to Decker Park and sat on the bandstand, and we were full of turbulent feelings. It was right there, sitting in the shade, that we made the decision that mankind wasn't ready to feel strange about the past. More strange than they already do. Then 7-year-old Lorraine came up, and we averted her fall. Still later that evening, in a full arm cast, she would print her name in the wet driveway cement with a butter knife, block letters which you can still see today if you know the address. Then we decided not to destroy the plans for the time machine, but to lock them away in a vault for all of eternity. We don't have a vault. What we did was we put the plans in code, and then we destroyed the originals. Then we cut the coded part into two halves, and we each memorized half. Lorraine asked me if I memorized my half, and I said, yes, I had. Then she burned the coded plans in a glass dish in the lab. Did you memorize the first half, she said. I asked her. I did, she said. And I know the last half. We looked at each other. I could tell she was thinking about mankind and how mankind would feel walking through their old homes in the past, seeing their folks and the old toys and the place in the wall where they'd hit it with a frustrating etch-a-sketch, and how they would know if they went up and talked to their mothers. Nothing good could come of it. Nothing would be created or averted, and things were confusing enough. I wasn't thinking about mankind. I was thinking about how young her father looked and how he watched us as we walked by. Of course, we had the wrong clothes. My running shoes had to look weird. He probably thought we were from Europe. Lorraine said, with this information, half in your head and half in mine, we should never be in the same room together. That's true, I said. It's dangerous. We should just get a vault. We were having a last coffee sitting in the two deck chairs we put outside the back door of the dry cleaners. And though the view is just the alley, the two trees across the way were full of birds. My fire hydrant was right there by the curb. I saw it all the time now. Are you ready for tomorrow? Lorraine said. She meant, was I packed correctly for the trip to Broken Ridge? We were studying continental drift now, and the escarpment would be revealing. It was our budget trip, just a few hundred miles, but the weather would be a factor. It could get frigid on the Broken Ridge. I think I'm prepared, I said. I had already stuffed an extra kit with all my winter stuff, including the great complicated mittens Lorraine had given me after our trip to Canada. She'd be surprised to see them, and I liked having them banked away. Departing in the dawn is always bracing. We decided long ago that dawn had midnight beat as a time of day. I made a thermos of coffee, and we had toast and paper napkins, though we have a policy about eating in the car. We amended the policy when we realized how wonderful it was to have toast and coffee as we drove through the early light. When I make the coffee, I put the cream in the thermos, and that seems like a treasure, too. We both take cream. Lorraine drove us out of town and into the foothills where it was only big government installations or ramshackle trailers at the end of dirt roads. The trailer places were all the same with their junk in the yard, and they all had a basketball pole. But we never saw any people. It would have been fine to see someone outside shooting a few free throws. Then we entered Throwback Canyon and drove up the sinuous highway beside the creek. We didn't speak, but I could tell Lorraine was excited in the way we get when we're out for a day or two, driving in the world. We'd had the toast and coffee, but that wasn't it. Travel in a new day is a blessing, and we took it as such. We would learn some things today. Would you have wanted to know me as a girl? Lorraine said. We were at the junction at Raindown, and we turned onto the narrow two-lane that leads up to the Broken Ridge. You mean as a kid? Yes. I would have liked that. We'd have been friends. I fell down a lot. You never broke your arm. No, but I had the skin off my knees for years. I came off my bicycle regularly. Would we have gotten married? The canyon was steep now on both sides, but the pines were thick up each slope. I lowered my window, and the air was like tonic, quick and clean. I said, maybe it was better that we waited to meet in school. And then we had a chance to tell our childhoods. You told me about that fall, but I didn't realize it was that far. You could have broke your neck. I told you I fell off the bandstand and broke my arm. The bone was sticking out. I remember that part, but seeing it was different. Would you rather see it or hear about it? I thought this over. It's an old question. Hear about it. Have you tell me the story? Like when you messed your pants at camp? Oh, boy. I was scared to use the latrine. I know. I like the story. Should we put the code back together and go back there in time in the time machine? Maybe you could help me. No, it's a good story. I'm sorry you were embarrassed, but you got over it. No, I didn't. It's right here. Still, I'd rather have the story. What would I have done? I'm not your mother. Here's the summit, I said. And we came around the big bad turn where the road curves at the mountaintop. The guardrail, a gigantic white fence, serious and ancient, with many gashes where others had met trouble. The valley now opened below, run with the meadows like light green stains between the stands of trees. The gray palisades of the broken ridge stood at the far side of the valley like a steel wall. There were no cars on the old road, and it felt like we were a long way from home. Lorraine drove to the trailhead with its Forest Service sign, the Broken Ridge. There was one red motorbike, but we were the only car on a Tuesday, and we got out into the balmy mountain day. The sun was bright, and the air was bright, and the few big clouds were clumped up like packages. Lorraine split up the lunch kits from the cooler and divided them into our day packs. She took the camera, and I took the binoculars. "Here we go," Lorraine said. She was dressed impeccably in her khaki hiking shorts and cotton jersey. I think she had a sweater in her pack. I was going to be too warm, but so be it. "It's good to be back up here. Let's go see where the continent broke in half." The trail is informally called the Fork Trail because you come to a sign with one arrow going up and one arrow going around. We had been very happy the last time we'd been here. It was years ago, and I had tripped just past the sign and skinned my knee. Lorraine had come up and bent to me, taking my elbows and asking if I was okay. She knelt where I was sitting in the dirt, and it was like my head was clear for the first time in my life. And in the deep forest shade, I could see her and beyond her, and I said, "Let's get married." She had her handkerchief at my knee, and she sat down there in the trail with me, and she carefully fit herself into my arms. It was early October that time, and the day was cold if you were in the shade. Now it was warm, and we were both here to research continental drift. Lorraine stood at the sign indicating the Fork Trail. I pointed at the lower trail, the same way we'd gone years before, and she said, "Watch for roots in the ground." The way was shaded, and the world smelled of pine and earth. It was an easy walk this way, along the bottom of the huge mountain, and then it looped around and climbed the ridge. We walked briskly along the clay trail. Lorraine has a stride I have always admired, and she led the way. She stopped at Ridge Creek, where there was a little bridge, though anyone could step over it without missing a step. "Let's go up along the creek to the cliff face," I said. We had never been up there, and it would be something to see. There was no trail, and we stepped through the moss and over and around the fallen trees, and in a moment it was as if we were in a new place that people had never seen. It didn't take long to come into the thickening gloom below the mountain, and then we could see the dark curtain ahead, and we stepped carefully right up to where the rock face thrust out of the ground and up into the sky. It was like some kind of gray shale, and we put our hands on it, cool and smooth. Then Lorraine took my wrist and pointed. Over a downed log to one side was a pile of clothing, shirts and shorts and underwear on top. She kept her hand on my arm, and we walked the other way, down along the stream quietly in the quiet place, only the creek whispering. At the trail, we drank some water, and she led us along the old loop trail. The ascent was reasonable, and we proceeded step by step, steadily breathing and not talking. The climb was the result of the continental drift. The aspens were half yellow in their season, and their tickets were bright on the dark trail. At the top, we came into the sunlight again. Here the pines were smaller and far apart, and there was a trail along the ledge, and we didn't stop to appreciate the view. At the very top, Lorraine sat on a warm rock shelf, and I sat beside her. The air was moving in a sure current, not a wind, but the air coming up the shale cliff and releasing in our faces. The valley was a green dish below us, and it gave way to the darker forest horizon and then to the white blue of the sky over the planet. "Do you think ideas are contagious?" Lorraine asked me. "Our research has shown me that they are," I said. She had her pack on her lap, and she brought out her lunch. I brought out my lunch. As always, we traded sandwiches. I poured two paper cups of creamy coffee from the thermos. She'd made a turkey with Swiss and English mustard, and I had made a turkey with Swiss and English mustard. I had two little bags of potato chips, and we opened them. "Are you tired?" she asked me. "I've been a little tired. We've taken on some big projects. This is a big project." I pointed to where the earth curved. "The time machine about wore me out," she said. "Do you remember your code?" "No," I said. "I replaced it in my head with a song." "You don't know any songs." "Not the words," I said, "the melody." "What song is it?" "I don't know the name. I can only hum it." "Hum it," she said. I hummed it, but I can't hum. She looked at me while I hummed there at the cliff edge. "You didn't replace the code with that." I sipped my coffee. "You're right. Why do you want the code?" "I don't know," she said. We were both thinking about the strange look her father had given us. We were both thinking of her catching herself. Maybe we could use the code later and come back to this day. We could come back to this Tuesday. We'll have to try harder to surprise each other with our sandwich making. You can't avert the sandwich making, Ron. What are you thinking about continental drift? I asked her. Do you want to let it go? We'd looked at the globe and saw how the continents fit one time and how they would fit again if it came to that. It's big, she said, but no. What's the effect, do you think? Look, she said, and she pointed straight down. Without continental drift, we'd be looking at that couple making love. They'd be right there, 20 feet. I'm glad you saw their clothing, I said. We were eating the potato chips and just talking. It was just the beginning of our research. We were just looking things over. The chips were salty and they tasted very good. This rock right here, she said, reaching back and unplugging a round rock from the earth, would be down among the other rocks where it rested for thousands of years. Now it is up here in the sun. She put it back carefully in the exact spot. Do you want to make love? I asked her. Let's, she said. It seems like the place for it, but not so close to the edge. Back here, she pointed, in the vicinity. We looked back to the banks of the small pines in the vicinity. That's what continental drift has done forevermore, created vicinities. My heart had shifted privately in the way that always surprised me. There is a first time for things, but every time Lorraine and I spoke this way, it felt like it was leading to a first time. I was looking in my pack. I didn't bring a blanket or anything. I've got a bandana and these mittens. I showed her the beautiful gloves. Oh, Ron, she said. She stood up and led me back to the generation of trees that had grown up so near and so far above all their cousins. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ron Carlson. You're amazing. So I don't know if any of you are writers, or if you're all record people, but for those of you who are writers, I highly recommend, if you would like to be productive one day out of your life, reading Ron Carlson Writes a Story. This is amazing, this book. It's unbelievable. I read this book, and I wrote 20 pages. I've never written again, but that's long enough. It's a novella, almost. Anyway, many thanks, Ron, for flying in for this. Paget Pell is the... Oh, and also, a lot of his books, I don't know how to pronounce them, and I'm not embarrassed to tell you that. Okay. Okay, I'm a little embarrassed because when it comes to the time when I have to pronounce them, I'm really not going to know what to do. So let's see what happens. Paget Pell is the author most recently of... Well, there's a question mark, actually, on the cover of the book. So that could be the title, or it could be the interrogative mood, right? Interrogative? Interrogative. Interrogative? All right. Whatever. Smart people knew how to pronounce that. He's also the author of, here we go again, it could be Adisto, or it could be Adisto. Whatever it was called, it was nominated for the National Book Award, so they knew how to pronounce it, and three other novels. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, The Paris Review, Esquire, and other publications, as well as in Best American Short Stories and Best American Sports Writing. He splits his time between Gainesville, Florida, where he teaches writing at MFA at Florida, the writing program of the University of Florida, and in Brooklyn, New York. I give you Paget Pell.
All right, this is an odd book, and I want to read a little bit of it if I have any time left to prove it. And that won't be much. I'm not going to read too much because this business has gone on long enough. Are your emotions pure? Are your nerves adjustable? How do you stand in relation to the potato? Should it still be Constantinople? Does a nameless horse make you more nervous or less nervous than a named horse? In your view, do children smell good? If before you now, would you eat animal crackers? Could you lie down and take a rest on a sidewalk? Did you love your mother and father, and do psalms do it for you? If you are relegated to last place in every category, are you bothered enough to struggle up? Does your doorbell ever ring? Is there sand in your craw? Could Mendeleev place you correctly in a square on a chart of periodic identities, or would you resonate all over the board? How many push-ups can you do? Are you inclined to favor the Windward Islands or the Leeward Islands? Does a man wearing hair tonic and chewing gum suggest criminality, or are you drawn to his happy-go-lucky charm? Are you familiar with the religious positions taken regarding the various hooves of animals? Under what circumstance or set of circumstances might you noodle for a catfish? Will you spend more money for better terry cloth? Is sugar your thing? If a gentle specimen of livestock passed you by en route to its slaughter, would you palm its rump? Are you disturbed by over-technical shoes? Are you much taken by jewelry? Do you recall the passion you had as an undergraduate for philosophy? Do you have a headache? Why won't the aliens step forth to help us? Did you know that Native American mothers suckled their children to age 5, merely bending at the waist to feed them a field? Have you ever witnessed the playing of shuffleboard at a nudist colony? If tennis courts could be of but one surface, which surface should that be? In your economics, are you generally laissez-faire or socialist? If you could design the flag for a nation, what color or colors would predominate? Should a tree be pruned? Are you perplexed by what to do with underwear whose elastic is spent, but which is otherwise in good shape? Let me pause here and say there was another risk that was contemplated that I had forgotten about. About 17 years ago, I placed an order of a man in this audience who was living in New York, where I was not, to get me wigwam socks, 4 pair, 100% cotton, size 10-13, white with a red toe line, unbleached if they have it. Also, 3 large bike jocks, swimmer. Signed Powell. And Michael Carroll up there never got me the socks or the underwear. We're both perplexed about the underwear, the jock straps. I'm not perplexed about the socks. I want to skip ahead at the risk of losing the narrative thread. If I may. Continuing with certain themes that have been established, I want to... looks like I want to go to page 76. Actually, this Rococo person... this Rococo person is determining this reading in several ways. You take just a moment here to make sure. Yes. All right. We're going to do this and then one other section. And we're done. Do you miss Tab and do you fully understand its disappearance? If you could have a guaranteed steady supply of an expensive or illicit substance or other commodity much prized and hard to get, what would it be? Are you surprised at the low number of people crazy or the high number of people crazy? Do Do you know offhand whether a hippopotamus sweats? If offered a cherry or a strawberry, which do you take? If you had enough money to live on, could you see retiring to a small village in France and never being heard of or from again, and not speaking French when there, mostly because you can't, but also because you have nothing to say and you'd have no one to say it to if you had something to say, and mostly just sleeping in your quaint medieval stone cottage? Could you make do with a little exercise once in a while and a piece of Beaufort of very high quality? And maybe a look in on the pigs? What if the cartoonist R. Crumb were your neighbor? Would you sleep better or worse or the same knowing R. Crumb was your neighbor in the next quaint stone medieval cottage in the south of France? Would life go on, or would you have to move to another village? Or would you have to abandon the idea of retiring to France altogether, realizing R. Crumb had done it, and that he was the tip of an iceberg going back through hundreds of persecuted, sensitive American martyrs, from the Josephine Bakers and James Baldwins and Paul Robesons to the precious Fitzgeralds, all the way up even to profane California cartoonists? Wouldn't you just be so yanked out of the frame that you'd feel it would be better to move not to gentle France, but to, say, Burma, where, like Jeffrey Dahmer in prison, you could be killed almost instantly when you set foot there? Wouldn't it be better to have a Muslim in Burma put a cobra in your suitcase on day two, then go through the long, pleasant sunset desuetude of retiring silently in France? Would it, in fact, not be better were you to assassinate 10 or so pleasant, silent American retirees on your way out of sunny France en route to your rude and immediate fatal neurologic toxic death in Burma? Would there not be cause for wild cheer among a certain kind of depression-suffering person who reads the headline, "Suspected Slayer of Cartoonist R. Crumb, Victim of Cobra in Burma"? Would it be the worst thing said of you that your last act was expended on behalf of the depressed? Do you want something said of you or nothing said of you when you go? Do you recall that the milk in bottles delivered unto the stoop that we miss so badly sometimes turned to a clabber so heavy and yellow and thick that it could not be forcefully shaken from the bottles? Was your looking into this clabber as rococo as bread pudding, as weird as a preserved calf, not unlike looking into your own crystal ball? All right, one poem warning. This is it. Am I wasting your time?
No.
Are you wasting mine? Can life be viewed as time wasting and time not wasting? Do the not wasters prove better off than the wasters? Are the wasters liabilities or are they assets to the not wasters? If a man is running a 90-degree grinder and it catches his pants and torques into him and he sees blood coming through his jeans at the crotch and he says, and puts the grinder down and sits on the bumper of his truck and lights a cigarette before investigating what is wrong in his pants and before heading to the ER, is he, would you say, wasting time or not? Are you peculiar about your socks these days, or at this point are socks socks? Is it really tenable that a person has a soul whether he has a cell phone or not, and a grasshopper does not? Do you know what it means to swedge metal? Are your shoes untied more often than it seems they should be? Do you have a dour cast about you? Is your cheer false and blustery? Is it a strain to smile? Does only convention and habit and cowardice keep you from being violent? If Jimi Hendrix walked in your room and said, "Sit tight there, Popo, I shall play you one," and affected to get out his guitar, what would you do? Would you say, "Wait, Jimmy, you're dead, lo these 40 years. Or, "Wait, Jimmy, let me call up a friend or two. Not a big party, mind you, but this is a special thing for me, and I want to share it with others if it's okay with you. Is that all right?" Or, "God, no, Mr. Hendrix. That shit would split my head open now." Or, "Lay some weed on me before you rip it, bro." Or, "Okay, Jimmy, but if the police come, do not call them goofballs, please." Or, "Dude, do you realize that the counterculture for which you are such a superb herald has become so mainstream now that your prodigy is invoked to sell Pepsi Cola?" Or, "Not now, maybe later." Or, "I was going to make a BLT. You want one?" Or, "Jimmy, man, I saw a thing you could dig on the ceiling of a gym in Montana. Some graffiti that said, 'There's only two things in life that makes it worth living: firm feeling women and guitars tuned good.' And it did not make me think of you when I read it, but now that you are here, you make me think of it." Someone had X'd over the W-O, so it could also read, "Firm feeling men. We've opened up a bit since you were here." Or would you say nothing to Jimi Hendrix at all? What if you said, "Play me some of that dang cock-stiffening guitar, James," realizing you did not know what his formal name was? And Jimmy said, "Oh, now don't go talking all nasty on me." What if you suggested that you and Jimi Hendrix go outside and work on your bird count? What if you asked him if he'd ever collected baseball cards? What if his ordeal, wherever he's been these 40 years, had made him a demon, and he leaps on you and tears out one of your eye teeth to use for a pick on this tune he purports to play for you? And you sit there, holding your bloody mouth and smiling when he plays it. What if the state of having lost your mind is exactly congruent to the state of your not having lost your mind? Thank you very much.